You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
Episode 63, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we talk about the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. Today's expert is Dr. Richard Menger, Chief of Complex Spine Surgery, Assistant Professor of Neurosurgery, and Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of South Alabama. Dr. Menger finished his neurosurgery residency in 2018 at LSU after receiving his MD at Georgetown Medical School. He completed a fellowship in pediatric complex spine at LSU before beginning his current position. And he also earned a Master's of Public Administration at the Kennedy School of Government during his research year in residency. Dr. Menger is also the author of the textbook Economics, Business, Policy of Neurosurgery. Today's discussion is about hospitals. Namely, what does it mean to be a nonprofit? Over half of hospitals in the United States are not-for-profit, but does that mean they look differently from for-profit institutions? Do they have competitive advantages for their tax status? What does it mean for patients, doctors, and the country? We hear all the time about how the profit motive doesn't belong in medicine, but does it? We will get into that as we review Dr. Menger's article from FEE, the Foundation of Economic Education, titled Nonprofit Hospitals Are Making a Killing. The articles mentioned today and the links to Dr. Menger's LinkedIn profile and previous episodes can be found at theparadox.com/063, and that's paradox with a CS. If you haven't yet done so, be sure to subscribe to the show now on your favorite podcast player. Finally, an unsolicited ad. I'd like to thank my good friend Ed Spires of MadeSimply.com. He and his team developed my wife's website for her new podcast, Losing a Child, Always Andy's Mom. If you need a clean website built at a very affordable rate, contact Ed at ed@MadeSimply.com. You can check out his work at his website, MadeSimply.com. Now let's begin my discussion with Dr. Richard Menger about whether nonprofit hospitals are making a killing. Enjoy. Welcome. I'm here with Dr. Richard Menger. He's a neurosurgeon who's just freshly minted out of fellowship. He's at the University of South Alabama. Dr. Menger, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to be on.
Yeah, well, like I was just talking before here, I've really enjoyed reading a lot of your pieces. And we're going to talk about two pieces specifically today at FEE, which is the Foundation for Economic Education. And it relates to healthcare, and I've done an episode sort of on this before, but I really want to get into a little bit more detail. And I think I'm hoping you have a lot more of the policy and certainly the numbers to go into more depth. And what I want to talk about is hospitals. And so to kind of lay the groundwork for our audience, there are sort of two main sort of hospital systems you might have. I mean, I think the days of the community county hospital are pretty much gone. The charity hospital has pretty much disappeared in this country. I think there are private charity hospital or Catholic hospital systems, but it's a system. Like if you look at the Trinity Network, it's nationwide. And so it's a very large corporate, but it has certainly has certain core provisions and sort of things that it holds important, like, not performing abortions, for instance, at their facilities or something like that, or not elective sterilizations. But essentially, you have these sort of two hospital sort of systems. You have the for-profit systems, and then you have the nonprofit systems. And so I think, why don't you give a little background on what the difference is between them and maybe what the similarities are, if you could?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. So I think, the connotation that is somewhat intentionally driven for the non-for-profit hospital is the charity hospital, the safety net hospital, the hospital that sort of helps society move forward. And I think that the connotation for the for-profit hospital is much more, new technology, making money, shareholders, investors. And I think, the data and the reality on that is that that's just not the case. I think, The the non-for-profit hospitals have direct and tax incentives. You know, they're treated like a traditional nonprofit entity, whether it be a think tank or a strict charity, in the sense that they're not paying federal, state, and other real estate type taxes for what they have, and while for-profit hospitals are. But the unbelievable report that was kind of the NIDUS through FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education, that John Miltmore sent my way from Open the Books, that just showed the unbelievable and incredible profits, essentially, that these nonprofit hospitals were making. And they skyrocketed just dramatically more than the for-profit entities. And, the first thing, and there's nothing inherently wrong in my sort of view that if someone's doing good work, they can be properly compensated. And if the hospital system is doing good work, they can be properly compensated. But I think that there's a lot of sort of manipulation of the system in order to help these so-called, non-profit hospitals generate large amounts of income for their leadership and for their institution.
So I think the important designation is that, when we look at hospitals like the nonprofit or the for-profit, I think the vision people have is that the not-for-profit hospitals are like they rely on donations from the community, philanthropists, some sort of significant state funding, because if it weren't for that, there's just no way they could get by. They're just kind of scraping by. And the for-profit hospitals, they've got like the Monopoly Man with his monocle and they're rubbing their hands all the time. But the reality is, I think, is that they're pretty similar as far as if you looked at it, you probably wouldn't know the difference. And do you have a feel even for the numbers of profit versus nonprofit hospitals? I mean, my impression is that most are nonprofit.
Yeah, most are nonprofit, and almost all that are in the top 10 in terms of so-called profits that they're making are nonprofit hospitals. It's conglomerate type systems that sort of benefit from this. So you had mentioned that you take the data in front of me, is for Partners Healthcare, which is essentially a conglomerate entity of the Harvard hospital systems in Massachusetts. They're receiving a lot of federal and state money to help them as a nonprofit entity. They received $25 million from the state in payments, $907 million in federal reimbursements for their services. But again, they're not paying the sort of full tax picture, and it becomes very challenging for me to sort of make sense of that. On the flip side, when there's very little in terms of price transparency for what they're providing, and I think that's one of the biggest sort of challenges in this space is you have a very complicated system, you have a lot of lobbying entities into this space. And you don't really know exactly what everything costs, but you see that the CEO is making $5 million a year, sort of exploiting a tax structure. And I think that's a challenging dynamic to navigate for healthcare in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things to look at is when you look at the nonprofit hospitals, I feel like it is not like this. It doesn't feel like the Salvation Army to me. It feels like if there was a different classification, not for profit, that would be what hospital systems today should be, because they certainly don't feel like they are charity. I mean, I know that they do work for the underserved; they take care of the downtrodden, but it just feels a lot different. And I don't know if that's because I'm within basically everywhere you work in medicine is within one of these systems, but they certainly don't feel like a charity.
I completely agree. I don't think they're even pretending anymore to be a charity. I mean, looking at the data and the Open Books report and other sources, the non-for-profit hospitals that are making money are larger hospitals in urban areas that actually don't have residents or medical students. There's obviously the big conglomerates that we just kind of mentioned that fall out of that. But, those are the hospital systems that you wouldn't necessarily These hospital systems are looking to sort of increase their payer mix just in the same way that any for-profit hospital system is. Nobody is fighting over the uninsured patient who has a prolonged disease course that doesn't have a high procedure-driven CPT diagnosis. Right? These hospitals, just like the for-profit hospitals, are searching for the same insured pool of patients. And I think they're just kind of using their non-for-profit status to maximize their sort of protection in this space through a tax structure.
So what is the implication of a hospital system that's not for profit? What difference does it make? Why should I, if I'm Joe Cube taxpayer in some city, why should I care if the hospital is not for profit versus a for profit entity?
Yeah, for me, I think if you're a patient, I think you're going to go where you think you're going to get the best care. And
right.
The reality is these not-for-profit systems in some of these cities, the Partners Healthcare, I don't mean to pick them. They're just kind of one of the bigger fish in the sea. They treat 1/3 of the patients in Boston, right? Either directly or indirectly. They don't. Let me be very clear. The physicians and providers in their hospitals treat 1/3 of the patients in Boston. But right. That's a lot of market power. That's a lot of sort of, infrastructure, a lot of sort of capture of patients, and it's hard to sort of ignore that when you're looking at a hospital. For me, if I was the consumer, and this is one of the main points of my article, is that if I was a consumer who could truly shop around and look and have a discussion, I would want to see what the outcome is and what the price transparency is, what I'm paying for. And there are some obviously innovative sort of outliers in this arena, but by and large, that's just not what you sort of see when you're the healthcare consumer. Some people shop by what's in their insurance network. Some people shop by surgeon branded name. Some people shop by institution branded name. But for me, I would say, okay, I have this disease. What are objective markers, and who can provide the best outcome for that?
Yeah. And I've talked about this in every show. It's really difficult for someone who is the lay public to get data that's reliable, that is relatable to them, and so you really have to rely on other people who are your primary care physician or word of mouth and things like that, as you would, I think, for most businesses, right? I think one could have a car mechanic and could state, how often you fix cars, well. But it's going to be really hard hard to trust the transparency, and also, whatever's wrong with your car, it might be totally different. It's something that they don't deal with very often. And so, anyway, I always think it's tough to understand, to compare hospital systems is very difficult. But I think to the point about the taxes, it seems like the one reason you're nonprofit is the one huge advantage, of course, that you don't pay any taxes, like you said, federal, state, or local, and that could be significant amounts of revenue from a local property tax standpoint. And I don't know what it's like in New York or Massachusetts, but most places they have lots of property tax. And so those communities are giving up tax revenue, I guess, for lack of a better, I don't like to think that the communities owed those taxes, but at least they're paying a different tax rate than other businesses in town. And especially when you go from a for-profit to a nonprofit, let's say a regular doctor's office, right? And now suddenly they become part of the nonprofit system. Mm-hmm. Their clinic is now changes status, right? And so you take it off the tax rolls for the community. How does that help or hurt other businesses or the hospitals itself?
Yeah, I think it's, there's about 60% of the hospitals are nonprofit hospitals in the United States. It's the majority of, I think it is the norm to be in a nonprofit sort of direction. I think these communities, realistically, it's a resource for the community, right? And I think also, too, it is a job creation for the community. We're at a residency at OSU, one of the main generators for, sort of employment in the area was a healthcare and almost a sort of a travel destination for a large part of a rural state was to that area to get healthcare. And I think that, politicians understand that they need those healthcare entities to you know, provide care for their citizens and for their constituents. And I think that there's a reality of just the economic imprint that those employers, literally, you know, as an employer, has to the state, to the region, and to the area.
Sure. I mean, I guess you could argue too, though, that if I'm a family practice physician, I'm an independent physician, I'm paying property taxes, I'm paying, you know, state, federal taxes, or whatever, for my business, right? Mm-hmm. And now I get bought out by a nonprofit hospital system because they are, you know, increasing their network of physicians and whatever. And now my business, which hasn't moved, it's exactly the same physical presence oftentimes, mm-hmm. but now its tax designation has changed. And mm-hmm. so I'm providing just as many jobs as I was before, but now I'm not contributing to the local. I mean, you know, all businesses contribute to the local economy. There's nothing unique about healthcare. I mean, I guess it's a different type of job, but it, essentially, all these businesses, you know, produce jobs and economic activity, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems like a benefit that is questionable as far as how much is it that much, you know, better to have. You know, healthcare jobs and other jobs that you're going to say we're going to forego all our tax revenue, and then additionally, you know, if we're going to give all that up, what do we get in response? Which I think is what you were referring to earlier with the transparency of the prices, right? You're sort of giving away all this stuff to these entities, and then you're kind of not getting any sort of right. information about what they're doing.
Right. I couldn't agree. I completely agree with what you're saying in terms of it doesn't make any sense. I mean, the reality is, in my sort of view of this, you know, the AHA, which is the American Hospital Association, which is the nonprofit and for-profit hospital systems sort of linked together in their lobbying activities, you know, it's $24 million in 2018. Right? That is an astronomical amount of money for their sort of, you know, arm to preserve, I'm sure, amongst other things, some of these nonprofit considerations that they're having. So, I mean, that's sort of the reality we kind of deal with. I mean, to put this in a frame of reference, I think, you know, your colleagues in anesthesia are the number one. We put out a paper in our neurosurgery journal last year, and the number one donating specialty of medicine is anesthesiology, and it's $4 million a year. So, you know, just seeing that kind of, you know, imprint that they have absolutely influences decisions and influences how things are going to be bought up. I think my biggest kind of, I think if you were to poll, and I don't have data for this, but I think if you were to poll the sort of average patient and they hear nonprofit, they're thinking of that charity care and doing the right thing and ignoring the bottom line. And I think a lot of Americans would be really, really shocked. And I mean, this is why some of this stuff is winding up in the Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, because people are relatively shocked that a CEO of a nonprofit hospital is making $21 million. And I think that's yeah. sort of the biggest sort of optics issue of what's going on is it's not just you know, that's not happening in for-profit hospitals. It is to a certain extent, but it's happening in the so-called, you know, nonprofit do good sort of mentality hospitals.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Rahas are they're either university systems, like I think probably that one you're talking about in Boston is probably is associated with Harvard, right? Mm-hmm. So that'd be, yeah. you know, and we have University of Michigan, obviously, and it seems like on some level I don't want charities to operate like charities, like they can't possibly work in the market. They don't work efficiently. They're not they don't have incentives to sort of do things properly and to, you know, use resources wisely. That so you want them to be sort of corporate and you want them to be managed properly. And so maybe those salaries are completely justified because as long as you view it as it's no different than any other, you know, for-profit system, that they should still operate with the same sort of parameters as far as, you know, making good decisions financially, being good stewards of their resources and those sorts of things, and to not just like throw it away willy-nilly.
Sure.
A lot of that money that is that you were talking about earlier with like $900+ million that are from $900 million just to that one health system in Boston, Partners Care, in mm-hmm. are those like direct subsidies above and beyond what they have in tax savings, or is that including the fact that they're not paying the taxes?
No, that's their Medicare reimbursement. That's how much the federal government's paying them. They're you know, my main sort of stick with that is that they're providing care. They're receiving sort of tax benefits for this, but no one still knows how much it costs. And right. No one really is showing that information, intentionally so, and no one is really doing that. And also no one's really disclosing the real prices the actual patients pay. So in that Open the Books sort of document that we use to write the article for FEE that you're referencing, only there's like 82 non-for-profit hospitals that are listed in that in terms of making a large amount of money. And only 17% of them disclose the amount of revenue that they got from Medicare, Medicaid, and none of them show the actual cost. So,
really?
Yeah, they are not, sort of being transparent. And there's no reason for them to be, right? If they are acting in the best interest of their patients, if they are acting in the best interest of service, they're acting in the best interest of the highest ideals of what one would in America would think is a not-for-profit. It's very different than the actual, sort of actions that are taking place.
Yeah, that's it. That's very interesting. It actually makes you wonder why the 17% reported in some
ways,
right? Like if there's not any requirement, it's interesting that you'd even say how much you're getting, although it's perhaps maybe those are state laws too. I mean, some state laws, may make it so you have to publicly disclose your revenue source or something like that if you got it. I mean, I'm just guessing. I'm speculating completely. But so what is the relationship between nonprofits and nonprofit hospitals and physicians, and how have things changed since, let's say, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare went into place? I mean, how have nonprofit hospitals changed since the adoption of that law? What was it, 2010 or something like that?
Right. Sure. I mean, for me, the biggest thing is got to be consolidation. The amount of consolidation happening in hospitals is incredible. And so, be very clear. It's not all negative, right? There's some failing hospitals that need better infrastructure. There's a hub and spoke model. All that. There are benefits to that, but they are significantly, they are buying up. Or other hospitals, they're buying up, primary care physicians in order to feed referrals to people in their system that are surgeons and, that tend to be higher, RVU and reimbursement models. And they're also buying up physician practices. Their argument is that it reduces duplication of clinical services. It can, streamline care. The reality is, it's also increased the average price of hospital services. It's just the market powers and economics argument. But I mean, I have seen that you're reading that in papers and in health affairs. You're reading that in some of the mainstream press, but I am really, and I'm sure you are really seeing that on the ground. And especially, I saw one aspect of that at Louisiana with a big healthcare structure and a big healthcare infrastructure kind of taking over portions of a geographic area. And then in New York, or the fellowship, it's a very, very challenging, very, very aggressive market. And you see this really happening.
How do you see the moral hazard coming to, why don't you describe what moral hazard is and then how that sort of plays into the nonprofit hospitals?
Yeah. I moral hazard, essentially, you're taking risks that you normally wouldn't take or behaving differently because you're insulated from the cost of something. So in my mind, it's kind of there is a distance between the person who is paying for a benefit and distance to the person who is receiving the benefit. So, that's the sort of the challenge with a central planning apparatus to healthcare delivery. It's a challenge with Medicare. This sort of generational taxation. It's not your sort of money that's being used to treat you. And that is a really, really big challenge in how people behave around healthcare. It's the idea to me that, you know, you're sort of, you know, you have insurance, you're entitled to it, so you're going to maximize every utilization, and the provider is, you know, synchronously not incentivized to sort of control their costs because the patient's not an active consumer. So, you know, people alter their behavior when they don't have to pay for something. So, you know, I think the hospital systems, you know, they're aware of this in the sense that, you know, they have a cohort of patients who are going to have a sort of a, you know, the insured patient is going to have a little bit of a blanker check than somebody who is going to be price conscious. So they're not necessarily going to care so much about the nitty-gritty of how much something costs if it's covered by their healthcare insurer. So if they can capture that insured patient into their network, if they can capture that patient into their hospital system, it can be a real revenue generator for them without the patient being sort of cost conscious. And I think that is one of, in my sort of, you know, understanding of economics and a lot of work that I've sort of done in this space, I see that as one of the biggest challenges with U.S. healthcare in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, you just have basically people trying to maximize the return for their premiums. And, you know, once you hit the deductible, you're incentivized to do as much stuff as you can. And the people who are providing the care are more than happy to provide it because they're getting paid anyway. That kind of just leads into the next paper. You'd written in February an article on why you, I think it was titled Why the Feds Will Eventually Force Docs into Government and Healthcare, which is a provocative title. And I guess you know, this is the question I always get. I've got the show. This is going to be episode 63. So all the show notes and to find out more about Dr. Megger, you can go to theparadox.com/063. But the question I always get from people in the OR or, you know, friends or whatever is, so how do we fix it? You know, how we got to this point where these large healthcare systems are buying up physicians. So you have from the physician standpoint where they're like, how do I get more autonomy? How do I am able to practice the way I want to? And then you have people who are like, well, how do you fix healthcare so it's not so expensive? Because the Affordable Care Act, the number one reason it was so popular when it passed is that it was going to slow down the rate of healthcare expenses. And I think it's accelerated when you about it by every measure. It looks like it's more expensive now to get care than before. And whether that's providing insurance to yourself or whether it's the cost of care, you know, with all the people who end up paying for it. So how do you fix that? And, you know, this may be the impossible question because I've tried answers myself. But, you know, like, how do you see that fixing? Or you can even just talk about the current proposals, because I think whether it's Republicans or Democrats, there aren't really any proposals that are looking to fix this sort of problem. And then how does that sort of dovetail? This is a 25-point question here, but how does that dovetail then get into why you think that's going to force physicians into sort of certain pathways?
Sure. So I'll kind of take a small bite out of this. You know, I think the first thing in that article that you were kind enough to mention is, again, through, you know, Foundation for Economic Education. And I was looking, you know, this is when we sort of first saw the imprints, you know, Kamala Harris after Bernie Sanders and, you know, saying Medicare for all and, you know, the idea that we needed one single payer. And Kamala Harris had just gotten on, you know, TV and said that, you know, private insurance is the thing of the past, and wouldn't it be nice to not have those prior authorization headaches, and we should outlaw private insurance. And, you know, there was an upcry in all the mainstream media, you know, about how are you going to forcibly remove private property from the, you know, 180 million Americans who have private health care insurance. And my article says, yeah, you know, that's a real, like, that is a real logistical concern. I mean, Vermont tried to do a single payer, and if it's going to work anywhere in theory, it'll work there, and it's hard. You know, that's a real argument to have. And my argument was also, like, well, what are you going to do with physicians? Are you going to force them to participate in this new system? Are they going to become now sort of state employees? Are they going to be a GS, you know, government type of employee? And how are you going to physically do this? And are you sincerely not sort of at least realistically considering that there's going to be some sort of two-tier mechanism. And then I sort of, went after some of the historical precedents that do indicate that, sort of the people prescribing these sort of healthcare policies tend to have a different set of standards for themselves. And, just the real concern of what are you going to do with physicians that don't want to participate in this? What are you going to do if they don't agree with some aspect of what you're, going to do? And then how are you going to mandate their participation? Because without the physician, then there's going to be no sort of unified healthcare apparatus. And I kind of pointed some of the data that, in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, and physician acceptance rates of those payments. So that was kind of my first, the first answer to your question is, it's a very challenging logistical issue for what they want to accomplish, the people that are putting those ideas forth. The other half of your question is a little bit heavier, but I think that, for me, if you actually look, if you take a snapshot of people who are kind of matching to specialties, some of the two hardest specialties are plastic surgery and dermatology. There's a variety of reasons for that, and one of them, I mean, it has to be, there's an aspect of that not covered by insurance, right? And the cosmetic surgery data, I think, to me is fascinating, right? I mean, there's no, as far as I know and as far as I'm aware, there's no healthcare insurance that covers cosmetic surgery. And, that data is, the cost of that has gone down 68%. The inflation is 68% less than what it's been for the rest of medicine, right? Because there needs to be some sort of accountability for outcomes and costs when the person's actually shopping for it. So obviously, okay. that doesn't work for that. Obviously, doesn't work for a lot of medicine, but it gives some insight that, obviously there are market failures in healthcare, but we need to sort of empower the patient as best as possible to be a consumer in the limited way that they can realistically be. And I think the first thing that comes with that is, price and outcome transparency. Outcome transparency, much harder to find real outcomes that matter. And a lot of, very, very, have a very long conversation about what that means and the outcomes for that and, the implications for that. But, the price transparency, it would be like going to a restaurant and, not knowing how much something costs and being okay with that time and time and time again. And, I think that would be a big part of the piece is mandating price transparency and looking to create that. And then the other thing, which would probably be much more controversial, but, I again, on the idea of reducing moral hazard and sort of, understanding there are market failures and finding a way for people to sort of take ownership and power of the decisions that they make and where and why they want to spend certain money in certain ways. And I find it interesting, at least in 2019, that our healthcare insurance is largely still in the private sector employer-based. There's favorability for that. Absolutely. To me, that's a vestigial sort of origin of wage control in the 1940s. And we don't look to Amazon. We don't look to, whoever you work for, Home Depot. We don't look for them to take care of your housing. We don't look for them to take care of your car and transportation in most cases, right? So why are we all of a sudden linking these employer-based insurances? Well, the unions love it, and so does the Chamber of Commerce, right? Because they get a huge tax incentive and a huge tax break for it. And I feel like that really manipulates and really sort of changes the system of delivery and perverses it a little bit. And I think that, in maybe giving people their money back and having them put it in different spots that they want would bring more sensitivity to the healthcare delivery system.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you said. And I think it's very interesting. I feel like the employer-based coverage is really just an artifact of the tax code, right? If you said, anyone could get their insurance and that you could pay with pre-tax dollars, suddenly it removes the you know, the necessity of having a job to have insurance for one thing, to lower your cost by, you know, whatever it is, 33% or whatever your tax bracket is. And I think, you know, it's important to point out too that we have markets in medicine. They're very distorted. They're so far from what anyone would consider or even question being a free market. You have to really look hard to find a free market system anywhere within medicine. I mean, outside of, like you mentioned, a couple cosmetic procedures, although even plastic surgeons, they do reconstructive surgeries and all kinds of things that are, involve insurance too. You know, the ophthalmologist maybe with their LASIK surgery, but outside of that, it's really hard finding any sort of market, you know, because very little people make their consumer decisions. I mean, there are HSAs, but it's what, just a couple percent of the market. I also find interesting that people are surprised that a lot of physicians are in favor of a single payer too, because from an administrative burden, for one thing, I don't think physicians think through things all the way. And so just because you're an expert at medicine doesn't mean you're an expert at other things and think things through any more than you expect your lawyer to be a really great mechanic or mechanic to be really great at practicing law, you know, right. To expect that physicians would understand healthcare policy really well, if they don't really spend a lot of time thinking or delving into it. I can see why they'd be tricked. Maybe it's a little strong word, but it might be accurate in thinking that a lot of their problems that they have in medicine would go away with a healthcare system that is like a Medicare for all or a single payer system. Like, oh, there wouldn't be prior authorizations. There wouldn't be, you know, sort of this, that, or the other thing. These headaches I have, the charting would be a lot easier, submission for bills. When every experience with any sort of government run process or any sort of top down bureaucratic process, it doesn't even have to be from the government, is the complete opposite, right? So I don't know why physicians are in favor of that, but a tremendous percentage of physicians really think a single payer is not a bad idea. I think it's probably close to 50%. I mean, I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but I think it's about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can see that, you know, where you fall into that. And I think too, you know, the physicians by and large, maybe I'm still sort of delusional, but you know, a lot of people genuinely want to help people, and the system is genuinely frustrating. And that just Medicare for all, it's a campaign buzzword, and those things stick, right? They sort of work in people's minds as an availability heuristic, and you know, that just makes sense. I think my concern, and I don't want to speak for you, but it sounds, you know, very similar. Having the right to health care does not guarantee access to a limited resource.
No question.
You know, and it's just a matter of how you're going to limit it. So right now we limit it to people who can pay, and we've deferred a lot of responsibility to insurance companies to sort of clamp down on who they're going to authorize to use certain procedures and things like that. But it doesn't guarantee that you're going to have access if you open up a single payer. There's going to be a different type of rationing that's happening.
Yeah, I think, well, and I think to your point, I think in your one paper you mentioned that in 2017, in the city of New York, 76% of physicians accepted Medicare, which means 24%, almost a quarter of physicians don't take Medicare. Well, I guarantee you, at least by all surveys, the reason people go into medicine is to help people. And the number one personal satisfier, which I say in almost every show for physicians is well over 85%, is the relationship you have with their patient. And that's because you're helping people. That's why we go into medicine. I mean, I think, you know, all the other benefits are there in medicine too, but the reason we practice is to take care of people. And anything that thwarts us from taking care of people is very frustrating, and we look for solutions which may or may not, you know, be good ones. And I think the reason people aren't taking Medicare is not because they want to drive the Mercedes, although some of them probably do, but it is primarily because it just from the economic realities, it doesn't work. And so the thing that I think scares physicians when they talk about single payer is that not that they'll be controlled by some entity dictating how they practice medicine, which I think is a reality that'll be very frustrating for them, but the concern that suddenly they're going to have to, you know, be paupers, and they'll have huge student loans that they have to pay off, and they're now going to be dependent on someone to pay these things off, that because they can't make it with their money, and they're not going to be able to pay their employees to, you know, their nurses and med techs and billers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a reality of doing business, right? There, Medicaid, right? The data you're kind enough to mention some of the Medicare data. I mean, the Medicaid data is even worse. I mean, you know, it's like a third of the Medicaid patients, right? Right, there's some other things and layers to that and worthy of discussion, but some of it is you just cannot afford to do that, right? And it sometimes it costs money to see a Medicaid patient in certain scenarios, and you know, that's a consideration for the system. I think that you know, I was fortunate enough in residency to have exposure to the VA system. And, you know,
yes,
lots of positive things from there, lots of challenges from there, just like in any other structure. But one of it is that, you know, there's an aspect there, there's a different mentality there in the operating room that, you know, this is something that we're going to give care, and we're going to give a certain amount of care and a certain amount of time to a certain amount of people because that's what we're budgeted for. And if we don't use enough, that creates a host of problems. And if we use too much, that creates a host of problems. So, you know, those people are I would argue, some of them, you know, very motivated to take good care of veterans. And it's a system that sort of works. I think one of the closest ways to what a centralized, you know, single payer healthcare system might look like.
Yeah, certainly one that we'd have access to in this country. You know, and there are advantages to. And I think just to those physicians who point to a single payer, I think there are advantages to that system in that it removes a lot of the variability in the system and, you know, what you can and can't do. The problem is it's very rigid, and the ability to innovate, to do things differently, to, you know, see more patients or less patients, it's really not even, it's not in the deck. And it really is very much, it's a more obvious rationing. I guess there's always rationing that we do all the time in our time and our, you know, what we select for food and clothing and everything. But it's rationing that occurs outside of your control and what you may value and think is most important either as a clinician or as a patient. And so I think it's hard to imagine that Americans would be okay giving that up. I mean, yeah. I can see them giving up, not realizing that's what they're giving up, but
right.
And maybe after the fact that buyer's remorse. Right. But, I don't know. I guess that's always my, I do see the value of the VA system in some ways, but overall I don't find a whole lot of veterans who are super excited about it. I had a guest on who insisted that it was really great. I tend to disagree as I worked in, it was great for training. I mean, they're like the best patients and you're so much fun because you could do they just love getting any sort of care because they have such, lack of care oftentimes in the VA system. So any sort of attention and care they get, they're really appreciative.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like you're hinting at I really struggle. So, you know, you have a medical student or a young physician and you get $180,000 worth of debt and, you know, 2020 comes along, we're going to now have a single payer healthcare system. I just, what is the government going to do when a physician does not want to participate in that? I really, you know, what is the next course of action after that, right? Because I think a lot of the things that I'm hearing is not, you know, not so much a two-tier system, right? It is very much one system for everybody. And I just see that it's the only way to do that would be with some sort of force, some sort of law or force to essentially take away private property of individuals and force them to do something at bequest of the government that they formerly were not forced to do. That to me is a very, very challenging logistical argument. I just, you know, don't know what that would look like.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, you know, when you look at the programs, you look at the cost, it is really different. If you just take the current Medicare system and say, we're just going to give that to everybody, well, you're going to have an access issue right away, right? Because right now, they're already quarter of patients can't find any, or physicians don't even take it Medicare. So to your point, you either force people to take it, or you have to increase the reimbursement. If you increase the reimbursement so that it's, you know, pay that it can, you know, people can keep the lights on for their practice, now suddenly the cost goes up tremendously, and how are you going to pay for that? Are you going to pay for it with debt, just printing money? You know, there's got to be some way to pay for all the resources and services that you're providing. Well, I really appreciate the discussion. It was a lot of fun. Can you briefly talk about the book you wrote, which is Business Policy and Economics in Neurosurgery? Because I don't think many people probably think of business and policy or economics to associate with neurosurgery.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I have a unique sort of joint appointment here at South Alabama. So I'm creating their complex spine center, an assistant professor of neurosurgery, and then assistant professor of political science at the university, too. So, you know, in neurosurgery residency, everyone takes 1 year sort of out of the operating room, and I got a master's in public administration government at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And when I was there, you know, I kind of saw my research going in that direction. I wanted to learn more. I want to understand how people were thinking, who made the rules about what we did, and some of the higher level sort of thinking and action about this stuff. When I was there, I was just absolutely blown away by, I think we as physicians are very siloed, and we are absolute experts, subject matter experts in anesthesia or neurosurgery or you know, medicine or infectious disease. And the people who are making these rules are planning on a much different wavelength. So, you know, I just wanted to bring some of those core concepts that are not sort of normally in the medical school or the residency curriculum, sort of bring it into, you know, written format. So I think it's 64 different authors, about 27 chapters, 300 pages. And what we did is said, okay, you know, you're looking for a job, this is what you need to look for. And sort of goes through what a good contract looks like, what a bad contract looks like, you know, how you're supposed to search for things, what does medical malpractice mean, and then how do you run a practice, you know, what does a work RVU, what should your account receivable look like, and, you know, real mechanics of running the practice and what you need to be aware of. Because, you know, my sort of mission with this is, I know for 100% that the person sitting across the desk from me that you're just negotiating with, or talking with, or on the phone with, they know it, and this is their job.
Oh, yeah, right.
And when you sign a piece of paper to the university about your intellectual property, that's probably written by someone who's an intellectual property expert or lawyer in that space, and you're just sort of blindly signing this document that's given to you in a packet, right? So how to, you know, keep physicians educated about that stuff. And then the next part goes into policy, and what does it mean, some of these words, and, like, you know, the implementation of different policy aspects, and you know, prior authorization. And then the last is sort of big picture economics. What is it going to look like in the future? How can I best take care of my patients in the evolving future? And sort of little nuanced differences in different types of economics of what we do. So the idea, just again, to sort of bring this stuff to the physician reader. So we got a lot of good feedback for it, and I did it with Dr. Nanda, who's now the chairman of neurosurgery at Rutgers, and then Christopher Story, who is an MD, PhD, he's one of the smartest guys I know. He's in Nashville working for a hospital system. They're setting up their stroke center. So just trying to, you know, bring this to as many doctors as we can. So,
yeah, it sounds like a book that's actually not even that specific to neurosurgery. I mean, there's certainly certain aspects with the RVUs and surgical volume and things like that. But I mean, for the most part, it could probably be applicable to just about anyone who's in residency or training to learn more. And that's, you know, I would occasionally go back to Iowa where I did my training, and I would give a talk on, you know, what to look for when you go to private practice or academics, whatever, when you're looking for contracts and sort of what sort of practices there are out there. And I had pretty much every resident except the ones that were on call who'd attend the meeting, because I remember when I was a resident, I had exactly 0 hours and people telling me what it was like when you left your training, which maybe not as surprising for anesthesia as specialists as it might be for someone who would traditionally be expected to go into a practice by themselves, like a, you know, a primary care. But they also are, I think, for the most part, not given any sort of instruction as sort of how to go out in the world after you're done.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you're negotiating, you know, if you join a hospital system, you're negotiating with someone who their job is negotiation. And it's usually your first time doing the higher level negotiation. It's just as simple as that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the discussion. I appreciate it. If people want to follow more of what you're doing, writing, do they find you on Twitter, on a website, where would the best place to look?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I do a lot of obviously peer-reviewed research, and then a lot of op-eds that run different, you know, periodicals and newspapers, and work as a faculty network member for FEE. So I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I post a lot of my things I'm doing clinically and research and socioeconomics through that. And then we are currently, you know, building a website for our bigger imprint here at South Alabama.
Okay. Well, Dr. Menger, thank you so much for your time.
All right. Yeah, thank you so much. This is wonderful. Really appreciate you having me on the show.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.